I heard you talking about growing monarchs right before I came on here.
Yeah, Pat, go.
That sounds neat. Pat?
It's an incredible experience because, and we also, Carol and I got this, we call it the Blooming Butterflies program at Bloorview. And the kids love it because in a month, the egg transforms first to a caterpillar and at the end of 30 days into a monarch.
Wow.
It's just amazing. And they walk onto your finger and you put them on a flower and they fly away.
So what a body can do.
Absolutely.
Some bodies. Wow. Did I hear someone else come on? Yeah, Martha was there.
Yeah.
There's a place here in Colorado, near Denver, called the Butterfly Pavilion.
Mm-hmm.
And it's this huge indoor ecology.
Yeah, yeah.
They grow butterflies, and there's all different kinds of butterflies there. And it's kind of like it's almost like a rainforest.
Yeah.
It's really nice.
Yeah, there's one in Key West, and yeah, there's one in Ontario, too. I think maybe there's one in Quebec, but I'm not sure where it is.
There is one in Montreal. Yeah, I think so.
But the monarchs are endangered species. So, and those little eggs are very, very tasty to a lot of predators. But they eat milkweed, and the reason they only eat milkweed is because it is poisonous and tastes really horrible to birds and to other animals. So, therefore, the caterpillars aren't eating as much. It's Cora.
Hi, Cora. Hi, John.
Hello.
Hello.
Morning.
Morning, how are you?
Well, thank you.
So I think Jocelyn should be coming on, but we could maybe get started. She's often a few minutes late, so. So I'm greeting you all from Vancouver today. I'm out on the West Coast visiting with my brothers. So it's 8 o'clock in the morning for me, which is a bit early, but, so we have the last two, well, we have the last chapter and then the postscript, but the postscript is quite long. It was it's almost longer than any other chapter in the book. So, and the first bit, which is an interview. So I thought one way to frame the first bit, which is what a body can do, would be because we've been, I don't know about everybody here, but certainly I was trained to think by sitting still. And so and over time, I've learned that that's not quite how it works. If you sit still, you can't think. You have to move in order to think. So you have to get up and you go get a coffee, and that's what stirs up the juices so that you're actually thinking. So the thinking and the moving is actually, you know, the idea that you sit still to think is wrong. It's not the way the body works. But what I was thinking about was how can we change our own practices so that we, from this culture where we sit still in order to think, how do we integrate practices that allow us to be more mobile when we think? So that's kind of a question that I want to start the conversation off with. And then we'll move into the second part, which is the part of how do we become active with the world and society. So the activist part, which is which is what the postscript is mostly about. But the two are related questions, I think, because how we become active is also related to movements. So I'll open up the floor to whoever wants to say anything.
I don't mind starting. What we know is that the habit in the Western world to have children sitting still with their arms on their desks and their hands folded and so-called paying attention started at the turn of the last century when education started, formal education, and many children were masturbating at their desks. So in order to keep the children from moving, the only way that they could as they were sitting still, they were instructed to put their hands on their desks. So, you know, sitting still. And now we're seeing this huge increase in ADHD diagnosis, attention, hyperattention deficit disorder. I think we're understanding more what it's like to, especially to restrain boys to sitting. And Cora's work really illustrated that. And when we think we have so many children who are, and I'm using this in quotations, wheelchair bound and have difficulty moving, we can appreciate what that means for their learning and for their socialization.
Anyway. Well, I'll just follow up on what Pat has said, because indeed, you know, this is something that we've been thinking about and observing for many years now. And having had the privilege of witnessing children move about in an important childhood environment of a school classroom, no less, I think we can take our lead and to answer one of your questions you posed, Jeffrey, like how do we integrate movement into our lives in a way that supports the thinking? I think we just have to watch children. I think what we were able to observe in that classroom and how children were interacting with one another, the kinds of events that emerged and dissipated, you know, really without any intervention of any kind. I think we can really take our lead from witnessing how that takes shape, what that choreography is within a particular environment, and what those cues are, what those encounters mean, and how that may influence, you know, the thinking process. It certainly has influenced mine. I thought as a researcher in that environment, I would sit still and watch these children move. And instead they drew me in to that vortex and to that hurricane of movement. So I'm sure that activated my thinking in a particular way. And that was on their doing. And as well, there's so much neurological evidence right now, and I'm a little bit behind in the recent advances, but we know neurologically that there's circuitry in the brain that is really connecting the cerebellum to the prefrontal cortex. A lot of experiments are being done to examine that, but I don't think so many from the perspective that perhaps we're looking at, and also in a real world environment. So I could talk endlessly about this and this, what a body can do. Chapter 8 is a kind of perfect conversation for me today, in the sense that I feel like I can bring with me what we have experienced already with these children, what I've experienced with my own children, and what I've experienced as a dancer as well too. And if there's a right moment to share that, the latter component of my experiences as a dancer. I know there's been a lot of conversation over the last couple of sessions about movement, and I'd be happy to share that at the right moment today. How many are we today? Five? Are we five? Oh no, there's Marco. Okay.
Well, I can share just a little bit. Something I do during our calls even, I have a almost compulsive need to write while I'm listening. And what happens in that process, it's like I'm not as focused. It allows a kind of a freedom or a play to enter in. So if I'm sort of almost automatically recording or recording significant things I hear, then this kind of frees up some other kind of creative faculty or receptive faculty, intuitive faculty. So I find that that's a form of movement that's, it's not pronounced, but CIIS had a part of their mission statement around multisensory learning, and that included movement. And so the students were, the students I worked with anyway, were very dedicated to that and wanted to explore it. We did things like sitting on cushions on the floor. They often interpreted it as ergonomics, but there's so much more potential in a movement-based education than I've seen used yet. Some of the students I worked with at Naropa came from Montessori backgrounds or Waldorf backgrounds, and there's a lot of movement integrated. I was fascinated in Aaron's description about how activating one touch or one sense for in autistic perception or for autistic people can free another. So I don't understand that fully and thought it was, I'd like to understand that better, I think.
Hello, Jocelyn. So just a sound check. Do you want to unmute yourself just to say hi?
Oh, hi. Hello, okay. Sorry to be late.
Can I go next?
Yeah, John.
Okay. This is really hard to describe or to articulate, and it makes me extremely nervous to even try. A story I was very moved by, Milton Erickson. He was a psychiatrist, probably one of the greatest hypnotists who ever lived. He had polio when he was 18, and he was paralyzed from the neck down. They didn't expect him to survive, but he did. And he was, he was told that he would never walk again. And so he was in bed, and his little sister, who was a toddler, was learning how to walk. And, she was taking a few wobbly steps and falling on her butt. Then she would crawl for a while. Then she would try to stand again, fall down on her butt. And she did this for weeks in the room where he was convalescing. And as he observed her over these many hours, he had nothing else to do, something got reactivated. And his kinesthetic intelligence, as he described it, started to get reactivated. And he learned through this field effect, I think, this relational field with his little sister, she reactivated his sensory kinesthetic intelligence, and he learned how to walk again. He walked with a cane. He was quite a magnificent man. You see him walk into a room with that cane, and he was also colorblind, so he couldn't see anything except purple, which was the color of the garment that he wore. He only wore purple. So you saw this guy walk into the room wearing purple with a cane. He was put everyone into a trance right away, just because his presence was so odd. But I find that story, I was also paralyzed in my right leg for 3 years, and I was in a back brace. I had an injury playing football. Ironically, a game I've never played ever again. but I think that experience of being in a constrained, I had to wear back brace, and I couldn't take the back brace off. And they warned me if I made a mistake, I would end up in a wheelchair the rest of my life. So there are all these prohibitions and constraints, psychological as well as physical. But I was able to read, and I was able to read a lot. And while all my other family and friends and young persons my age were out dancing and getting into trouble, I was reading. But I think there was something that happened that got really accelerated in my sort of development that I noticed it sort of put me at odds with other people. And just to I look out the window and I can trace with my eyes the fire escape, okay? Now if I take my hand, I can trace that same trajectory of my hand, okay? So I see and I can feel. And I think what's interesting is what is in between that visual and that kinesthetic proprioceptive. I think that when she's talking about differentials, she's talking about the differences between groups. So I think there's differentials between our different senses. And there must be considerable overlap. I think exploring synesthesias, people are very attuned to these differences and these overlaps. And I think creative writing actually engages that multi-sensory overlapping intelligence between the senses. So I think also, I just had a dream last night talking about field effects and differentials and synesthesias. I remember last night, just one section of it, I was in this sort of magical city, and I was meeting all kinds of odd and interesting people, and they were giving, and one of them particularly gave me some very good advice. But as I was leaving that place, everything was sort of, there were different rooms and different spaces, but they were all sort of loosely juxtaposed with one another. So you could leave one and go into another one, and you could be aware of certain transition zones, which were not like the physical world, but were sort of like the physical world. But I was joined by a companion who was walking on my right, and as he was walking next to me, I felt the need, I wanted to lift up and start to float, to fly. And I thought, oh, well, I wonder if he's going to be impressed by this. Probably not, but I couldn't do it anyway. And I just sort of walked, and I sort of just intended to get lighter, and I started to float like a balloon. And he did the same right next to me. So we were both floating. And I felt there was a kind of, I could feel it was all telepathic. Extremely kinesthetic. There was a visual component, but that wasn't the most important. And he, as we were rising, I could sense that we could touch. My subtle form and his subtle form could touch, but we didn't have to. Because there was something so about the sensory overlaps were so intensified. That there was a difference. He was different, but he wasn't so different that we needed to rely upon the conventions of the physical world. Not to be confused with the waking world, because I don't think the physical world is awake very much. So anyway, I'm just saying this was a field effect from having experience in the physical world, having these contacts and perhaps some would call a transphysical or a, if not transphysical, an extraphysical, or some, I think what Erwin calls something that's more than. And I think that that sort of excessive more than that you can experience in life, the more livable it is, the more bearable it is. Even when terrible things happen, you still have those imaginal zones. And, you know, if the terrible injury, such as this young you know, Milton Erickson, he healed himself from, he was able to walk again after polio. I think it can have enormous pragmatic effects. So I'm just sharing that because I don't know where I'm going with this, but I just find it's always in the in-between, those interstices that Aaron keeps pointing to over and over again, and how we make the cut. And also disentangling from the critique, the cultural critique, which is all around us, which basically says, you know, if you're gay, you're doomed to alcoholism and prostitution, and you cannot love. This is what I read about homosexuality when I was 12 years old. I did an extensive research project trying to figure out what the hell this stuff was. And the consensus was, you're doomed. Same thing came up when the AIDS epidemic hit. The medical establishment, the pharmaceutical companies, the church and the state all agreed that this group of people is doomed. And I've always resisted those critiques. I've always wondered, where the hell do these critiques come from? And if you really look at the undercommons, as she's quoting Fred Mutnick again and again, you realize how they have a short shelf life. They're born and they die rather quickly. But it's how much we try to keep them afloat. I think we should let a lot of it die and not give too much energy to critiques that go nowhere. But anyway, this is just my response to, I think, an excellent question about sitting still. Because I think you can sit still and move at the same time. Thank you.
Thank you, John. I think the field effects are really interesting. Interesting, and the way that field, in order to attend to it, it means attending to all those minor elements. So the minor gestures, but the minor, the little things we don't pay attention to most of the time because we consider them negligible, and yet they're the things within which the field resides, I think. And so I'm still sort of feeling my way through what we, you know, I was writing yesterday and in a cafe, you know, so typing and thinking, and after about half an hour of that, I had to get up and walk around just to stir up the, you know, because it's hard to write. So,
I just to add something to that. There's I haven't read the book. It's called Mirror Touch. Excuse me, the dogs are barking outside. But this is a physician who has this condition where he can feel another person's pain in his own body. And you would wonder why you'd want to be a physician if you have this condition. It's pretty rare, but because if he gives him an injection to another person, he feels that injection in his own body. And he thought everybody had this until he was like in his mid-20s. He was diagnosed with this condition. He found out it wasn't universal. But I'm wondering if neurotypicals, you know, there's that kind of neurotypicality, there's that kind of neurotypicality, but maybe there's something in between all these neurotypicalities that overlap. Because I think empaths or psychics are probably tuning into this kind of field also, where they can register affects and sensations that are not supposed to be coming through their body, but it's supposed to be coming from that other body over there. But I think that those who are extremely disembodied and dissociated and pretty much staying in their heads probably have learned how to turn that off, that capacity, or, you know, not to pay attention to it, as you mentioned. I mean, it is sort of paying attention to the minor gestures that sort of reactivate these this vast kinesthetic intelligence, which I think I'm visually oriented, but I don't think there's anything comparable to the kinesthetic intelligence. especially when you go to bed at night, go to sleep and enter into that vast kinesthesia, which I think what our the universe actually is. So anyway, I think there are all kinds of projects that could start to emerge as we start to train ourselves to, and I hate to say train ourselves, but I don't know what else to do, to pay attention to these neglected, just usually at the peripheral aspects of our intelligence. No doubt many of us are writers or dancers or performers because we've been attracted to that in between what isn't paid attention to by the big gestures of our culture. Much food for thought there.
Well, there's a lot to be said for movement, but there's also something to be said for, actually, a train going by. There's also something to be said for stillness. And your question, actually, even before your question, you said that, and I'm speaking to Jeffrey now, but I'm going to, I think, be able to loop back to John and the other comments as well. You said that you have to move to think. And I realized that when I sit still, and I practice sitting meditation, I've been practicing that for 20 years now. So it's been a almost daily ritual or discipline of learning how to sit still. I sit still not to think. And I didn't realize that until I heard you say that you know, we put a value on thought and on the movement of thought and the generation of thought and thoughtfulness, that, you know, as something that we can cultivate. But in order to do that, I think we also have to have a kind of fertile field or a kind of open field of non-thinking, of unthought. And one of the benefits of sitting and of cultivating the ability just to sit, not to move, because a lot of times movement is in response to something that arises. It's kind of an unconscious going about things because of an inner energy that isn't really reflected on. One of the benefits of sitting is that it allows a more careful examination or more careful study, if you will, of what arises prior to movement, because the whole discipline is to sit and not move. So something arises, the feeling, the impulse to get up and get a drink of water or use the bathroom or move in some particular way. But the sitting, and there's an enforcement of this, it's like it's like the executive function holding the body in place. It's an asana or a poise. It allows the perception of the impulse, and then to see how the impulse propagates, how it sort of ripples out from wherever it comes from. It comes from, you know, from I'm now kinesthetically feeling it coming from inside my body. But as one becomes more still, one can perceive subtler and subtler movements. And as kind of the grosser impulses exhaust themselves a little bit and diminish, subtler ones come up. And then, you know, different traditions have different ways of speaking about this. We have our kind of sense of gross body, our gross physical, muscular, skeletal body. But as Aurobindo, Sri Aurobindo, and other, let's say, more spiritual thinkers posit, there's also a subtle body and a causal body. And the subtle body is full of movement. The subtle body is kind of the dream body or the imaginal body. But the causal body is not. It's very still. And I think that having that sort of being able to move as between the bodies, or to kind of inhabit the bodies simultaneously, you know, so that there's a sense of stillness even in the movement, and there's the ability to discern movement from stillness or within stillness. I think that's very valuable because it allows more subtler perception even in waking physical world. Movements that are more obvious or on the kind of grosser level, because you're not caught up in them, because you have a sort of stillness in relation to them, don't as much move you. And I think you can then pay attention to or notice better the subtler movements that, you know, or the minor gestures, as Aaron Manning would put it, that in a curious way that I'm really curious, I feel I'm learning about. And Aurobindo is kind of attuning me to this. And I think Erin does in a different way because of the way that she really decenters the centralized subject and highlights the field effect. That subtler seems to be more powerful. That's what's interesting about it. And just how it's more powerful, I think, is what I'm curious about, what I would like to learn more about.
I'll just interject here. It seems like an appropriate space to talk about a physical experience that came to me actually just recently in reading this text, obviously. And I think, Marco, what you're alluding to as well is Aaron's notion of pre-acceleration. And we've looked at that quite a bit with the children in the kindergarten classroom, and that movement that can be sensed. And I suppose it really relates to the virtual and the actual, and how Deleuze and both Manning understand that. But that movement that is sort of ready to be displaced, don't know what that is, but it exists. And so when I was reading through all of this work and through our discussions as well too, a performance experience came back to me, and that we had a choreographer, his name is James Kidelka. He was the artistic director of the National Ballet for a number of years. And he came to the Toronto Dance Theatre to set a work on us. And the name of the piece is called 15 Heterosexual Duets. And what he did was match partners, male, female, in ways that you wouldn't typically match particular dancers. So usually if you're a jumper, then you would be matched with a jumper. If you're a more lyrical dancer, you would be matched with a more lyrical dancer. So he created this kind of tension where the jumper was with the lyrical dancer. And he set this piece to Beethoven's Kreutzer Sonata, this glorious piece. And we actually, John, we brought this piece to the Joyce in New York. So it was, it remains very much a part of who I am. It remains in my body, really, with what happened in those rehearsals. James is this, if, you know, nobody was reading Manning at the time. I don't know if James ever has, but now that I am, I can go back and live that experience again in a slightly different way because of what I'm reading and what we're sharing through these sessions as well. What James would do, he'd come into the room and again, this sort of odd matching of people, and he'd set the stage, he set the circumstances really for something to happen. We always questioned as dancers as to whether he knew, that he had it in his mind, the images of what he thought he was going to see, and we were convinced that he did, because he could work so quickly as well, choose that he must have this set out in his mind. But now that I've been many years later now, in another place in my life, and I'm reading different things, but I still carry all of that movement in my body and those memories. I think what James was doing really was setting up what Aaron is asking us to do, where he would set up almost, in this particular set of circumstances, almost the impossible, where he would say, okay, if you could repeat this phrase of eight counts, I'd like you to do that in the span of 2 seconds. In my mind, I'm sure at times I actually uttered the words. I'm sure I said, James, please. Honestly, that's impossible. I can't do that. But I said it in my mind all the time. I might have uttered it a few times in my frustration. And it wasn't a test. It wasn't really a test. He was setting up the circumstances for something else to happen. That pre-accelerated place that he knew existed, that he could sense in all of us, because he knew us quite well as dancers as well too. And then he would set the parameters around that to see what would happen. And in the end, and he did this time and time again with each couple, with, you know, a 30-minute piece of choreography, I'm convinced now that he didn't know what that was going to be. He waited quietly. He didn't get up and do this. He sat quietly, and he asked us to meet particular structure. And Marco, you and I have talked about that a little bit as well, too, those, that structure, sort of pressing against particular structures to see what would happen. So I realize now, interestingly, as I've, you know, this was over 10 years ago, 10 or 15 years ago, as I am now watching what I would call choreography in life. I didn't expand on my career in a way where I did some choreography, but it wasn't my overarching goal. I have found myself in this place because of the encounters I've had in meeting Pat, and we talked about that the other day in meeting Jeffrey. I found my place, myself in life now, where I'm actually observing the choreography of other people and of children. And what I'm seeing is what I because I have sensed it in my own body of what that pre-accelerated place is. Not that I could identify it, not that I could articulate it, and that's a problem with language as well, too. There's no way of articulating this. But I have this sense of something else that can be that I don't know what it's going to be yet. So if there's anything I can do, and this might leap into the next chapter here, if there's anything I can do, if I could set the circumstances or the parameters for children to move from a pre-accelerated place to a displacement of movement, a movement that they have never experienced before, then on a very, very small level, that would be a contribution that I think would be very rewarding for me. I'm withdrawing myself as a performer now. I don't need to perform. I don't need verification of academically or artistically. I see myself drifting backwards and onto the periphery of just simply watching this happen and finding ways and the strategies that Aaron talks about in setting up environments in particular ways, in particular encounters in which all of this can unfold itself. So just a short story, really, to have gone back into my dancing life and having felt through my body what some of these concepts and ideas feel like, and then trying to articulate that with a language that I still don't know or have developed yet. Thank you for listening to that. That's been an important realization for me, and nice to share with you.
So I thought one of the things that you mentioned in passing at the end there, Cora, was this idea that it's linguistically difficult to talk about this stuff. So these field effects are, I don't know if they're pre-linguistic or even post-linguistic, but they're not linguistic. And so that's also...
Yeah, I think Aaron talks about it as pre-linguistic, but I agree with you. I don't know. It's definitely not linguistic, is it? But I feel it's been such a privilege to have experienced it on a bodily level. I think. I mean, I can't say for sure, but when I read what she's writing, I think I identify that on an embodied level. So that's the next task then. How do you articulate that, and how do you use that for how do you apply that? How will that make a difference in somebody else's life? It's not about my life anymore. It's about theirs.
And the other question I have that's coming up, which is a kind of a next level question, is that we've been doing these, so on the Infinite Conversation sites, we've been doing these video chats in all sorts of different circumstances. And so what is the relationship between Aaron's questions about movement and thought in the context of the video chat? So for instance, one of the things I feel like what I want to do is to change the way.
It's true,
eh? You know, so that we don't have to be always the same. Great.
That comes from a thousand plateaus, Jeffrey. He talks about turning ideas upside down on their heads. This comes directly from a thousand plateaus.
So, you know, and it's interesting because if we're in a meeting in a room, we all share the same space and we all have the same movements in our peripheral vision, you know, the same set of things going on. But in this video chat context, each of us has a very different peripheral space and we kind of see a little bit of it, but we don't see, you know, we don't really fully share it. So how does all that work? How does it even work in a way, you know, that it can, that we can sit in a virtual context like this and even understand each other? Sorry.
Whole other question.
I wonder if there's a cycling aspect to this, a kind of life cycle. Like Coralie, the way that you have moved or feel yourself moving from being a performer, being kind of the star of the show, being, you know, what rivets the attention, to holding that. And like that sort of centrifugal movement to the outside, but still embracing or holding what is, you know, what becomes the performance of others. You know, I could see a sort of movement even there as one goes through the phases of one's life or of one's career. Maybe this occurs on grander scales as well. I think that relation, and when I think about meditation and where my attention is going, there's a desire to go into stillness. So there's a movement towards stillness, but then out of the stillness arises a desire to move, a desire to get up, to walk around, to dance, to make things happen, you know, in the world. And I think from the kind of grand cosmic perspective, perhaps there's something like that going on, you know, on a universal level, like Big Bang and then big, you know, expansion into nothingness and then a sort of reemergence of another universe. I don't know how that works. But I think, I mean, one thing about the body, and what is a body capable of? I imagine you experience those kids in your body.
I think so.
And which part of your body? It's not like your liver or kidney or heart. There's some other dimension of your body where you experience the kids, where you experience others.
I think it's in the rhythm. I really think it's in the rhythm. It's almost like because that's what we noted in the data as well, that it was the speeds and slownesses, and you could almost begin to sense that something was going to happen, but it was usually a rhythmical change of some sort, a change in tempo. You could feel those changes in forces, and Deleuze talks about that quite a bit, but the change in, like, you knew that something was about to take place, an event of some kind, but nobody had any control over it. It was just this cueing and responding and moving. And if you spend time, and Pat is quite fascinated about this and has talked about it a lot and written about it, but watching children in a playground is the most magnificent piece of choreography that you could ever watch. And a lot of choreographers have actually used that. And I think what it is that sort of sensitizing yourself to those changes in rhythm. So I think that's when we go from movement to thought to writing, I think that's where I'm really, you know, sort of sitting on the edge of, is how to introduce rhythm into the writing that actually reflects the children's movement. So that's why I said, even beginning this conversation, I think we've got a lot to learn from children. And I've said it in previous sessions as well, too, that there's a lot to be observed and carried and felt through their interactions with the world, because they are of the world. As Aaron says, it's not bodies moving in a space. They are moving with their spaces and with each other.
Can I respond? This is these kinds of questions, which are very deep and very profound. I think we need to chunk slow. And when I mean chunk slow, I mean chunk slow and chunk down. I've often interviewed people, many different ways of interviewing. I've also done a lot of hypnosis and working with trance. And the first thing you do is pay attention to the qualities of your own voice, which can transmit a kind of rhythm. And that can induce very quickly a very relaxed state of mind body for both persons, because then you are in a field, an area of influence. And I think we do this with children. We do this instinctively when we're taking care of someone who's sick. We know that we have to change our rhythms, our tempo rhythms, in order to enter into a field that's that allows for something different than our conventional sort of setup, where I'm here, you're over there, we have some project, or we're going to go out and have lunch or whatever, but we're usually in a very fast. So I think I was very touched by what you said, Coralie, about those imprints of your dancing, in many occasions of performance, and that gets imprinted in the body. And there's something else someone else said. I'm sort of losing my train of thought. Is it in the body? Is it outside the body? This is something I often ask people. Is whatever that insight is, or that feeling is, or that communication, whereabouts is it? Does it have a size or a shape? Is it inside? Is it outside? And some people, it's curious, they say, well, it's not inside. Is it outside? No, it's not outside. And if it's not inside and it's not outside, whereabouts is that? And I think that's where we're really entering into the field within the field. And it takes, and you have to really slow down, and you can impose your own metaphorical constructs. You have to sort of really, really, really relax. The more you relax, the more I think the presence of the field can be shared. And I love that idea of imprinting and re-imprinting, because I believe our nervous systems are so flexible and so plastic that someone with a polio who's never supposed to walk again can learn how to walk again because they were able to tune into those fields, like Milton Erickson with his little sister. And reawakening, reactivating those imprints. And that was a kind of watching his little sister learn how to walk again, re-imprinted that. And I think, and that's probably why I'm so obsessed by dreams, because I have often asked for certain insights or understandings or, and sometimes physical healing. And bring that back with me into this physical, so-called physical world. I have a really hard time with what that could possibly mean. But these are the kinds of overlaps and what's under and what's above and what's in between, where those re-imprints can happen. Just telling you I had a dream last night and trying to just put into words that dream, it moves from a subjective space into a public space, and then it gets re-imprinted at a much deeper level than if I had just jotted down in my notebook or forgot about it, which is 99.9% of what we do, is just forget about it, have total amnesia. And I think the tremendous, because we're so fixated on this monophasic drive to dominate and to control, which we're all sort of, I think, trying to wean ourselves off of those competitive impulses to make a, get the gold star, or move to the head of the class. So anyway, I hope that some of that made sense. Thank you.
Beautiful, John. Go ahead, Pat. Sorry, I'll unmute you. Or yeah. Go ahead.
Okay, I've been, as I've been reading Manning, I've been kind of forced to watch some soccer with my husband. And I would strongly recommend for us to understand Manning and maybe to reach beyond Manning to watch some of these unbelievable best players in the world. They're like dancers, they're like chess players. And rather than look, what I've learned to do is rather than look at an individual player, to look at groups of players and how they are in pre-acceleration stages a lot and where it answers, or at least it extends the question that John just asked, where is that? Where is the eye? Where is the brain in figuring out not where the ball is right now, but where it's going to be three moves from now and how they coordinate? So instead of looking at an individual, one person, I think it's helpful to look at soccer teams, like organisms, like groups of people. And we did that in Cora's study too. But I'm learning to see how human beings, especially those who are extreme case examples, like the best soccer players in the world. And Bourdieu described soccer as a cross between dance and chess. And I think he says it right. And maybe a little bit of economics in there too. Bourdieu also talks about the process of learning to swim, which I think is also, I've kind of forgotten the exact quote from that. But I guess what I'm trying to say is that there are other ways of thinking these things, both other theorists, philosophers, but also dancers and soccer coaches and soccer teams. Like, just how do they do it? To come around, to put your foot backwards, to kick over your head before you know that's going to happen. And there is no time. There's no time for as John is asking us to do, to slow chunk. It can't, we're talking about things that happen in seconds. So that's just my little shot at the goal.
Oh, and I completely agree with you. I am fascinated by the same things you talk about, and we've had some of this conversation before, Pat, but I'm watching the World Cup now, watching my own son play soccer, I feel I can't sit and watch soccer because I am so fascinated with that. And I agree with you. I think it's a completely pre-accelerated moment that you maybe have a glimpse into, mm-hmm. of watching someone about to make a choice.
Yes, and
I think that's what James was trying to do as well, too. He just wanted to set up the circumstances and let's see what choice you make.
Yeah, because the soccer coaches don't know what's coming next. They don't know. They don't know what a game is going to look like. Also, I mean, we could look at many levels. We could look at the cultural imprint on a team. But I was just going to move to a slightly adjacent track to the boys, the soccer boys in the cave in Thailand.
Yeah, I want to talk.
How much did their feeling of being part of an organism, part of a team, and their ability to meditate? I think they were all Buddhist. I mean, we've just seen gestures that have happened that have been world-shatteringly important.
I agree. I agree.
What I think you were tuning into the field when you were watching the soccer game, rather than a partisan win-lose kind of dynamic, which can be very exciting. I think you were doing something different. And I, when I say slow down, I don't mean that has to be our habitual tempo. Actually, I think we slow down so that we can be aware of multiple tempos, multiple tempo rhythms in multiple groups. And I believe those players have, you know, they've lived together, they've created strategies together, they've practiced over and over again, and they've used their imaginations. And they go home at night and they dream. I'm sure in their dreams, these expert soccer players are re-imprinting themselves so that they can go out and perform those split second way ahead of outside of time and space kind of decisions, because you know what's going to happen before it happens and you can move in that direction. That's what I just wanted to stress is those field effects and how paying attention to all those minor gestures and the thrill that athletes and performers and people who create ensembles, the real aesthetic pleasure of those kinds of relationships, how can that spill over into our politics and into our the ways we do business? I believe they can, and I think on occasion that does happen. But I'm not, I sort of really respond to Aaron's look at, and she quotes Fred Moten a lot, and I'm wanting to read his book about these neoliberal kind of dynamics that are so frenzied and so demanding of our attention that we virtually have nothing left to heal our wounds and to assist others in healing their wounds. Because it's a tempo rhythm, which is invariant in a way. I mean, there's nothing. So anyway, those are just my two cents. I haven't figured this out myself, but I think there's considerable opportunities. I think to if we slow down enough, we can sort of find these invisible architectures which are organizing a person's way of being in the world or their way of becoming in the world. And then if we can tune into that invisible architecture of the group, I think we will be entering into those in-between zones, that in-betweenness can be a very dynamic and revitalizing aspect of our human and animal natures.
I so agree, John. And this notion of the collective came up just recently in that Toronto Dance Theatre celebrated their 50th anniversary. And when I danced with the company, this was in the late 90s, early, late 80s, most of the 90s. And at that time in Canada, the funding for the arts was very different from what it is now. So a group of 14 people could travel anywhere, and we did. So our life was really, you know, three quarters of the year was spent on the road together. So we lived, danced, slept, toured, sightsaw together as a group. So our life was essentially entwined on a daily level, on a bus, on a plane, going through security checkouts. Like you knew everyone to a point where I've never known people like that again in my life because of the time we spent together. And also that thing that happens on stage as well too, when you know someone so well that anything can happen at that point because you trust them in that way. I think that has huge implications for what can be done in terms of the collective. Where that's changed, and there's no funding for the arts anymore, not in the way that we had the privilege of moving and traveling together. And it's changed the bodies, literally, the physical bodies, and it's changed the choreography. In that when you go to see particular companies now from 20 years ago, there are more individuals on stage. There's less of a collective. And that's just simply out of the physical habit of being together and understanding one another. I think that has huge implications for moving forward. And that's why James also set up those weird parameters where he coupled people in these strange ways. Like maybe there's someone in the company that you didn't really identify with the same way or move together in the same way or And by putting those two things together at odds, in a sense, created a whole other thing. And we didn't know what that meant. And it changed relationships.
So I'll come to you, and Pat, in a moment. I'm going to move us forward. I'm going to take last comments on this, and then I'm going to move us forward into the next section. So go ahead, Pat.
I just wanted to say that where the World Cup soccer games are different is that the teams are set up as a mixture of, they don't all, they're not the same team over and over again. They're sometimes trying to score against their opponent. I also have re-understood the idea of a 0-0 score. And people often say, why would you watch soccer? There's never any score. They don't ever get goals. But that is the point. And it's fascinating when you kind of reorient your mind. Now I'd like to just bring up one sentence from Erin's first page of chapter 8, where she says, what makes us so certain that we can define a body in time and space as a separate and individual entity? And that is the question that intrigues me the most. And I, as I said last week, a lot of you weren't there, but this idea of the human being as a spectrum, a thing that is connected in all different ways, but isn't an autonomous individual entity. I know that takes us right back to first principles, but that's what Erin Manning has helped me to articulate more clearly. What does the enlightenment subject mean to us now? What if we throw it up in the air? It's scary, but it opens up. Anyway, Jeffrey, hope that wasn't too long.
I think it takes us into the next chapter, which is about how do the body, I say engage, but I don't think it's really engagement. It's how does the body live the relationship with the world or the relation with the world? So, and Pat asked last time that we do a close reading, and she picked a passage from the opening section of this postscript. So what I propose to do is to read the passage. So it's the whole first section. So we're going to slow down, John. And then we can talk about it in more detail after I've read it. Or maybe we could share the reading a bit. So it starts with the quote from Nietzsche, who she cites a lot in this chapter in very interesting ways. Into all abysses, I still carry the blessings of my saying yes. The minor gesture is an operative cut that opens experience to its potential. This operation is affirmative to its core. It affirms the field in its transformation, and it affirms the way this transformation emboldens the inact of experience in the making. Affirmation is the creative force of a reorientation in the event. What affirmation does, how it affects the cut, is what gives it effective valence in the event. The affirmative cut of the minor gesture catalyzes a reordering. Cuts are not good or bad. It is what they do that makes a difference. The affirmative cut is not the bestowing of a value judgment onto experience. Affirmation is not good or evil, optimistic or cruel. I think I'm going to stop there, and we'll just talk about that paragraph before we go on to the next, rather than reading the whole thing at once. One of the things that struck me about the rereading of Nietzsche is that I read Nietzsche years ago. I read the genealogy of morals and Beyond Good and Evil. I think that's all I read of Nietzsche, and it was many years ago. And so I have a kind of a vague idea of Nietzsche from those readings. But I find that she gives freshness to understanding Nietzsche in ways she has a way of looking at what he was writing that's different from the expectations I have about Nietzsche. So anyway, that's maybe anticipating what's coming rather than that paragraph, which is more about this idea of affirmation. I don't know if anybody has any particular comments they'd like to make about that paragraph.
Well, I read the end notes, which I had found very excellent for all of Aaron's chapters. So it's quite a long postscript about Laurent Berlin, who I don't know. But there's one sentence that I found really interesting here. The gesture does not mark time if time is a movement forward, but makes time, holding the present open to attention and unpredicted exchange. The grimace is such a gesture. So is a deadpan response. And I wondered if we could talk about that, like how a grimace is an affirmation. I don't expect anyone to have the answer, but it's just where my head went here.
Well, certainly when you write, I mean, writing fiction, a grimace is a way of making a statement about the character that can be very positive.
I remember Emily Dickinson's line, I like a look of anguish because I know it's true. Men do not sham convulsion nor simulate a throw, death throes. So I think the affirmative isn't necessarily a feel-good.
No.
And I think that's really important because you may feel really bad and yet be extremely affirmative because you're chunking perhaps in a way that isn't convenient or consensus-oriented. So, I mean, I just had an experience 2 days ago. I looked out on my fire escape and there was a little chick and it was wet and trembling. And there were adult birds around it watching it. And I don't know how it got there, whether it fell from a nest or whatever. But then the birds flew off and just left this chick. And I didn't know what to do. I thought, well, maybe I have to rescue it or something, but I didn't do anything because I thought, well, whatever I do, I'm liable to fuck it up. So I just watched it. And throughout the day, I saw it. From the morning to around noon, it was flapping around and moving around on the fire escape. And at the evening, was able to flap its wings and move up the ladder outside. And at the evening, it flew off. It flew away. But it was amazing in that I could see the motor skills of this little creature starting to come together. And it was such a mess in the morning, and there it was in the end of the night. In the evening, it was raised. But I started to feel like that's kind of a motif, I think, that I think I want to take with me in this next phase, whatever that is. So I think it's the more than and the more than human. I don't know if I'm answering any questions here, probably not, but I think there's something in our this our capacity to to consecrate ourselves by in very simple ways, just paying attention even to something that's awful, because I thought, oh no, this poor bird, is little chick, has fallen out of its nest and it's going to die, and I'm going to have to watch that. So anyway, I wasn't, by the way, just sitting there looking at my fire escape at the bird all day. I was out doing shopping, coming back and checking in. But I think this idea of a motif I got from Brian Massumi, reading a chapter from his book, because Aaron recommended it, about the feeling of what happens. And I think that's where those motifs start to come from. You know, you see something with your eyes and then you feel it with your movement, with your body. And that in between what you feel and what you see, those motifs emerge And I think those motifs are what we need to take with us so that we can take those leaps, or maybe floats as we float into a new cosmology. I think those the motifs we take with us are going to be what makes that sustainable. Because we're just switching from one cosmology. We don't do that too often, nor should we. We probably won't do it unless we have to. But I think, how do we rehearse that collectively so that we can coordinate anything at all together that's going to make sense? Is, I think, a very pressing challenge. So thank you for that question.
Go ahead, Justin. Hang on, I'll mute you. Here you go.
Yeah. Just to go back to the text of Nietzsche that you quote a couple of minutes ago, Geoffrey, and also to go back to about the synesthesia effect. Of course, the book is not the same time as Nietzsche, and the concept were really far away about the knowledge we had at this time, the knowledge we have right now. However, it's important for me to state that or believe about how we feel and how we get how we feel is really linked to education. Nietzsche was raised by a pastor as a dad. His father was a pastor, and he really had a bad relationship with his mom. The father with the mom was having very bad relationship, and it's the reason why. I mean, one part of it that the reaction towards religion, which was associated with the dad, was so strong. And what I really like about Nietzsche, it's not the thematic itself. It's more that the way he talks about his character in the book, as they are part of a truth that only them can build. Like, for example, when you have Enzo Sprach Zarathustra, he is like really in the state of mind of someone who is looking at the sun and say, oh, you know, if I was not there, you were not worth nothing, talking to the sun. And it's really like this. It's not really about ego, so to speak. It's more like talking about that if we were not there, if they were having no movement in the world, well, the world as we know will not exist, which is like a very trivial to say, but it's not trivial if you consider that only us can produce our time. We are the producer of the time. As a musician, when I work with others, of course, when I work with myself, I cannot really even think about that. But when I look at someone singing, when I look at kids playing music, well, they construct their own times. You can share it, but you will never be in the same time than them. You feel that you can be on the same tempo, but you are not part of their tempo. They know what they're doing. And doesn't mean that they are right in their tempo or they are wrong. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about they building something for themselves and they believe it is the truth. If you believe that only you can suffer and you don't feel that the pain is coming from, the other can feel your pain, well, it's the truth for you. And our beliefs are so strong. Our beliefs are so important for us that all the construction, all the mythology, all the injection we have from this will become so true that nothing else can be real upon that. So synesthesia, synesthesia is like, first of all, it's a neurological pathology at first. But with multimedia, people can use it to do wonderful things. You can capture the voice of someone and build graphics all over the place just using your voice, and you produce pictures. And it is a synesthesia process in multimedia. Of course, multimedia synesthesia is not synesthesia from neurological point of view, because synesthesia is a lot of suffering. People who have these states develop some drugs in their brain called mescaline, and they were really having some bad physical status in order to get this disease. And it's not something that coming as a joy. It's like a lot of suffering that disturb the endocrine system and provoke that. So we cannot say, oh, well, it was good, because it's not. But people who develop this because of their critical physical condition, well, they develop this because their whole system, their whole sympathetic and parasympathetic system were completely disturbed. And so all their belief that sound is there and voice is related to sound, so sight is sight, and all of these were completely disturbed. And so they build a new truth in order to survive. And like, for example, if you feel some sound and it's related to sight, well, image will come right away, because it's just like a learning process. You cannot even help it. So imagine that you were completely physically disturbed at the point that you can feel the pain of others. Well, it's becoming part of your truth. And especially if you think that everyone is like you, well, your truth is becoming more real, because you have the you become legitimate somehow, because others have also that, so it must be true. And well, in fact, it's what I wanted to say, is that really a difficult point of view to explain, because most of our science is based on our belief that we all see the same thing, and we state that it's true because we all see that. But if our parents show us that as a truth, well, it becomes part of a reality, and we cannot escape from this, and we have to see that as truth. So I would say, like, it's just like our belief are built on our own ancestor. And what I feel in the text of Nietzsche is that he's really, I mean, not in this quote, so to speak, but a bit in this quote, but more in the whole text, is really saying that it should not be this way. I mean, we have to take another path. Of course, we did it for maybe a bit of the religion, which was the main subject, so to speak. But I would say it's for everything. Yeah. Sorry, I get too much.
Well, I think if we continue a little bit more, it would tie in with what you're saying about Nietzsche and what he's really responding to in this idea of affirmation that Aaron picks up, because I think it goes very profound about our attitudes about the world. And you mentioned that he was raised in a very strict Christian upbringing. His father was a pastor. His mother and sister also, exerted an effect on the field of his coming into who he was. The affirmation is toward life, right? He saw in the Christianity of his time a denial of life and a aspiration for the other world, for the other reality. And then he brought that, he applied that critique also to Platonism and to, Hegelianism as well in its own way, because it affirms something other than the world, something other than actual experience. I appreciate that Aaron is picking this up, because it really gets to, I think, kind of the heart of, especially when you're dealing with politics and you're dealing with disability and with modes of being that are difficult, the affirmation becomes that much more important. So How much did you want to continue going, Jeffrey?
If you don't mind, Jeffrey, I don't mind reading that second paragraph.
Oh, yeah. Sorry, I was muted. So go ahead and read the second paragraph.
Because I think it ties in much of what we're talking about, even from the previous chapter as well, too. So Nietzschean affirmation counters the Hegelian dialectic. Where the dialectic builds on contradiction and opposition, affirmation refuses to stand against. Critique is not its motor, but neither is acceptance. Affirmation does not do its work according to the either-or of a field predetermined, nor does it seek to counter or accept the it being of given. Cutting into the event is not a process of negation or a dialectical synthesis. Affirmation moves at the pace of the differential, aligning to the event's points of inflection, to its operative tangents, where the form of experience has not yet quite emerged, which gets back to our notion of pre-acceleration as well. I would say that Deleuze as well too, if there was one way, then there's no way of describing Deleuze's ideas or concepts because they're so far reaching, but would also counter the Hegelian dialectic as well. The refusal to accept the either or of life and the components of life, and replacing either or with and is a huge component of the Deleuzian concept of the world. So I just love that second paragraph because it really affirms that understanding and approach. And also I love how it ends that paragraph in that we're always looking in terms of affirmation, what moves at the pace of the differential, aligning to the event's points of inflection, which we've been talking about quite a bit, to its operative tangents and where the form of experience has not quite emerged. That's beautiful.
It also, this passage, one of the reasons why I really liked it too, is that it reminds me strongly of Ursula Le Guin's writing. So because Le Guin drew on Taoist traditions a lot in her writing, science fiction writing, and even her fantasy as well. And so this idea that when you oppose something, you support it,
is
integral to her writing and integral to this passage, right? So this idea that affirmation is not the opposite of negation, because negation supports the thing that you're negating.
Exactly, yeah, that was
right. But affirmation takes you to a different place.
Yes.
And she discusses that more detail further on too. Mm-hmm. So.
Well, I'll just say, I think this is very important politically because we often get into the mode of opposition. There's a reality we don't like, or an idea we don't like, or a candidate we don't like, and the first instinct is to oppose, to say no. And that may be very important, but if that becomes the kind of dynamic that one is locked into, the dialectic that one is locked into, then one becomes very manipulable, actually, because you're predictable. Anything that's put forward to shock you, to cause outrage, is going to send you into this reactive fit. And while you're in reaction, you're not affirming the reality that you actually want to create. Instead, you're feeding and recreating the reality that you wanted to oppose in the first place. So I think this is a very important argument that Erin is making here. And she extends it through this chapter with these different thematics, you know, drawn from Nietzsche and Deleuze. But you know, I don't want to go too far. We can chunk it slowly.
Another, just a quick comment on the chunking. I noticed that John has a habit, a nice habit, of citing personal experiences, but one of the things that happens when he does that, or any of us that do that, that it does slow down the dialogue. The abstractions lead us to these very quick sparking off each other. But the personal anecdotes slow us right back down to accompanying the person in their own thinking about their own life. So it has a very different feeling to it. I just wanted to notice that part of attending to the field.
I think that's a very important dimension of our social lives, because when I tell stories in public, it rarely has much to do with me. I find that it's not personal. I think there's something that's trans-individual in our stories that makes them stories. They're communiques from the field. And I believe it's the interplay, what's in between the objectifying third-person account, which is evidence-based, and the first person. And I think what I've learned from this text and learned from many of our conversations here is how, and this is part of my mission in life, is to create conditions for a strong first-person account. Because when I was a teenager and I was reading all of this vast research on the pathology of homosexuality, which was the norm, I had to, when I was 12 years old, say, they're wrong. I had no evidence, but I have to do something different. I can't oppose them because there are too many of them, the church, the state, and the medical organizations. But I have to do something different. And I have to find other people who want to do something different also. So that's why I'm saying, you know, that first person is not necessarily that personal. It's actually, I think the trans individual is emerging out of that field of all possibilities. And we are anticipatory systems. We have to think ahead in order to make anything happen or to survive. So we're looking at a past, we're looking at many different pasts, we're anticipating many different futures, and we have to deal with the circumstances that are arising. And I think we need strong third-person accounts, we need strong first-person, we need those intersubjective stories as well. But I think it's the interplay of all of those different perspectives and points of view that contribute to our overall for ecologies, practices that are ecological. I found most of my education was dominated by third person. And I'm sure that's true of most of us. And I think it's still ongoing. We're looking for evidence rather than there is no evidence for this. I just want it because I want it. And I'm looking for something complementary to an opposition to someone, some other third person's evidence that this is the way it's going to be and these are the policies we're going to endorse in order to make certain things possible and certain things not possible. And I just, along with many others, say, it's not going to go that way. I'm not going to oppose you, but I'm going to really orchestrate something that's complementary. So it's either or is contained within both and either or and both and are contained with neither nor. So I think this is when we get those field effects, which, you know, take us by surprise. And some of these surprises are not pleasant ones because there are a lot of, and this is where I think we brought up earlier, Heather, we were talking about Gary Lachman's work and his look at the occult and the hidden powers, perhaps, in politics and the rise of Trump. And I think we should really start paying attention to that because these occult forces are working in our fields and we need to be paying attention to them because they can be minor gestures that turn into major gestures very quickly. Thank you.
Well, maybe I'll go on and read the next paragraph if we seem to have dried up a little bit. For Nietzsche, no, I skipped this paragraph. Affirmation does not yet know what the field can do, and so it neither predicts nor devalues it in advance of its coming to be. Affirmation does not position, it experiments. It is pragmatic in its speculation. Speculative pragmatism is experimental to its core, asking at every stage how the cut makes a difference. Speculative pragmatism does not comply with the existing parameters of experience. It does not stand outside them to judge. Speculative pragmatism, in the name of affirmation, invents, doing its work at the limit where what if becomes what else. So speculative pragmatism is the term that Whitehead applied to his philosophy. So it's a restating of some of the things that Whitehead talks about.
That quote, affirmation does not yet know what the field can do, resonates for me with later in the chapter where she talks about what I'm going to kind of reterm here as like a living activism. So if we think about affirmation that does not yet know what the field can do, it's an emergent activism or a living activism. And I'm curious about that as a type of participation in the world when we're in dialogue with so many non-living forms of activism. What we ranted a little bit, or some did last week, as like these rigidified neoliberalisms that are in some ways life-denying and are about duty instead of possibility. So I'm kind of curious about if that question has come up for others, or that's one of my inquiries with this chapter, I think.
Quick thought. I mean, what I think is so depressing about current politics is just the lack of imagination. It's that there isn't a sense of something better being possible. The message appears to be from, you know, the mainstream political parties and actors and agents and so forth, that we have to accommodate ourselves to reality as it is, and that as it is, what the narrative there is may have to do with the way that, you know, the market is, or the reality of, you know, the global economy, or what have you. But I think what would be exciting, what would be a living politics, or an exciting activism, would have that sense of what could be, would have that sense of possibility, that sense of that kind of streak of the infinite that actually inspires you to move, inspires you to go out and work for something, because it's not prepackaged and pre-delimited to a relatively non-ecstatic status quo, right? Like, I think probably, you know, there was a sense of that in the 60s, and there was the sense of a politics of ecstasy. I think there's a book maybe by George Leonard called that. And that just dissipated, it seems. Like, that just got buried in, the endless compromises, just kind of 1,000 cuts. But then those 1,000 cuts add up to, like cutting off your head. So I think part of the idea of the minor gesture is that we could find that living politics, not in the grand gestures of the politicians and of the parties, but in the context where we actually can attune to the field. Like, working with kids is not non-political, right? You're creating future, you're creating human beings with life force who are going to have effects in the world. And that may be the most potent thing that you could do, is to create a good human being. I don't mean create in the sense of, imposition of your will, but I mean to cultivate human beings who are sensible and who, whatever the context is in, not that it doesn't mean that they're going to vote along your ideology, but that they can operate in the world with sensitivity and with an ability to speak their first person and the third person and also second person in dialogue with others. That, I think, is profoundly political.
Yeah, I feel like education is, especially as we move away from the live component, begins to miss that transmission aspect where there's something awakened, whether by the teacher or by the parent, somebody who can inspire. I think that's the basis for what you're describing, or it almost has to be. I know I just opened a thought there, but I wanted to go back to what Johnny was saying too, if I could do that really quickly, about the personal narrative, because that's a question of mine as well. Something that's been, I've been thinking about for a while. I used to have a lot of trouble writing about the personal. And one of the ways I see it, if I could just think of it in terms of kind of like abstract shapes. So we have this, the power of the personal when combined with the transpersonal, I think is where this significance comes in. I mean, we have, I think it's Walt Whitman who says, I'm vast, I contain multitudes. And Clarice Lispector talks about the expanded eye, the eye that it's not just her. She's mediating through the eye of her text, the experience of the reader in a transmission based kind of way. There's a participation in that eye that goes beyond the boundaries of the individual. And I think being able to move into the transpersonal and then recover the personal as a modality is very human. And that's something I feel a commitment to, is how do human bodies suffer? And I'm oversimplifying these gestures. I've just seen myself dissociate from the personal. And so I think I'm extra mindful of it. But that's not saying we have to go one way or another, just adding to the conversation there.
So many years ago, I was very active in the anti-nuclear movement, including civil disobedience, and I went to jail for prison for a short term as a result of some of those actions in the States. So we appealed the case and we won the appeal, so that I have no record, but I did serve time in an American jail.
And is that an imprint?
It is an imprint. It is a life-changing imprint.
I could imagine.
And but so it was a nonviolent community that I was involved in, and you know, the goals of the community were to stop nuclear proliferation, nuclear war, and nuclear armaments, you know, which is, we were a tiny community. We were, you know, 20 people in different cities who were working together on this. So from the outside, it sounds a ridiculous thing. And yet it worked because it was all about the minor gesture. It wasn't about the big things, even though the goals was that were like that. It was all about the individual encounters with individuals. And so in the court process that we went through to deal with this, we had to deal with lawyers. And so we had encounters with the lawyers. We had encounters with the parole officers. We had encounters with the prison officials. And all of these encounters carried the feeling in this sense of that Aaron talks about earlier in the book. And they were profound encounters. And the people whose lives were touched were changed by those experiences. Did it affect things in the long term? I don't know. But I remain convinced that it's through the minor encounters, the small ones that don't seem to matter, where the real changes happen. I don't think you know, it's one of the discussions we used to have because we were involved peripherally with Greenpeace. But Greenpeace always had an approach, their approach to dealing with these sort of global change issues was to engage the media. And so all of their actions were designed to raise their profile in the media. And our goals were completely the opposite. We didn't want to deal with the media, almost not at all. We were interested in the encounters with individuals within the system, not within the way that it was raised within the media. So it was a very different engagement. But I remain, I mean, because if you look at the sort of Trump, was it Trump, anyway, I'm stumbling over the word there, Trumponomics or whatever, or the Trumpacopolics.
Trumpocalypse.
Those are the big things and they get you depressed. It's not, that's not where the hope is. The hope is in the tiny little encounters, I think. So, and I think to some extent, this last postscript of Erin's is her way of taking the thought that she put into The Minor Jester as a book and trying to see how this actually engages into The Minor Jester in this context of political change and social change. So how does one not get depressed from the global movements that are so destructive right now by looking for the minor gesture within the opportunities? Anyway, something like that, I think it's what, and I don't think it's fully succeed. I don't think she fully succeeds. I think she's trying to get there. Mm-hmm. And although I think the argument is strong, I think she's not quite there. It doesn't quite gel somehow, not fully.
I'd like to resonate with that example and offer something else I've been thinking about a lot. Daryl Davis in Accidental Courtesy, it's a film he made about his own activism that, well, he goes and speaks to white supremacists around the country and he talks to leaders in the Ku Klux Klan and other movements and befriends them. And he's a black man, he's a musician. And so he becomes best friends in some cases. And he's collected maybe 26, 27 robes of these hate group leaders. And he's gonna make a museum with them. So there's this beautiful scene, and I can post it after in the forum, where he encounters in Boston some Black Lives Matter movement youth, two leaders in the movement who are so angry with him for wasting 20 some years of his life. But it's a matter of how you look at the activist gesture there, I think, you know, the minor or the major. And I mean, that scene, it's so tense. I've shown it to several classes of students now, because this is an issue they have to face too. And, you know, where is the impact? What makes the greater impact here? And we have actual relationship that Daryl Davis is building. He's undoing empires by, you know, because these things spread through families. They're cults. They're done through a group mind or a field effect to some extent, I think, that we haven't fully recognized yet.
I just wanted to go back actually to something Mark was said and tie in thoughts that were said afterwards. And Marco, you were talking about how do we set the stage essentially for children to move forward into the world with a different, and I'll use the word possibility, I don't know if that came up, with a set of possibilities. And that's a very important call right now, I think. But what I would suggest as well too is that it's not setting up children to move forward into the world so that they can simply utter or speak to or on a linguistic level, simply share, you know, the opportunities that they may have been granted in order to think about the world in different ways and in terms of possibility. I would say that they also need to experience that on a physical level. but they need to know that through their bodies to be able to begin to talk about that as well. And that brings an urgency to children with disabilities, where, Jeffrey, you were talking about the minor gesture and where those places are. And the minor gesture as well are in those pockets of small environments, classrooms where disabled children can't get to because of the architectural setup of a classroom, where they can't actually come to and with and be with collectively the other children in the classroom. They can't experience the minor gesture on a physical level in order to understand the possibilities of their own bodies, in order to articulate that as a affirming and a way of moving forward in the world where they trust not only on a intellectual level what they have to say and what is possible in the world, but also how they understand that on a physical level, and that that is driving what they're understanding. So that's a call, and I bring that back to some of the work we've been doing, that it's an urgent call, really, to create the spaces in which children can be together physically, to understand the possibilities through their body, and then begin to articulate.
Just quickly, that later in the chapter, Erin makes the point, and I think she's echoing another argument, that what we call disability is just the reverse side of a society that doesn't accommodate.
Yes.
And so I think what you are maybe getting to is that, like, if we saw the value of the human being, of the child, whoever it is, then we would accommodate them. And if we accommodated them, then our society would be very different, because we would be orienting around that innate potential and allowing for it to come forth, rather than, you know, creating luxury resorts and golf courses and
yes,
corporate jets and
yes,
all of the totems, you know, of superiority or of, you know, some kind of otherworldly aspiration, rather than what actually is arising in our worlds as they, you know, that we in their most intimate expressions. So yeah, that's all. I think that there's that connection there, but it's very, I mean, it is so minor, that's the thing.
It is.
Can I respond? Once again, I'm sort of picking up on different aspects of what people are sharing here, and I'm responding to that. And Heather mentioned the personal and the transpersonal, and those overlaps, and that they can become part of the narrative. And the depression, I think you mentioned, Jeffrey, and how, with the global events. And I think Erin calls it neoliberal depression. And that's a unique kind of depression. And this whole idea of the media. And I'm reminded of James Baldwin, because he was in the 50s. Someone said, you're black, you were gay. Actually, it was homosexual. I don't think gay was even used back then. You're black, you're homosexual, and you're poor. That must have been very depressing, Mr. Baldwin. And he said, no, baby. I felt like I hit the jackpot. And I think that I'm moved so much by James Baldwin, because I was in my 40s and I read a novel of his, and he was describing the civil rights era back in the 50s. And he has this group of characters, black men traveling in a car through the South to get to Tuscaloosa, Alabama, where there's going to be a big gathering. And he talks about the dangers of traveling for black men in a car, getting out of the car to go pee in the dark and then rushing back to the car. Because in that in between, you could get kidnapped and you could get lynched. And he was talking about Tuscaloosa as a particularly terrifying place because there were more lynchings in Tuscaloosa than the rest of the South put together. And when I read that, I felt a chill go up and down my spine because I was in Tuscaloosa, Alabama from the age of about 2 to about 4, exactly in the early 50s, in the mid 50s, yeah, which is the time he's writing about. This is the civil rights movement that's just starting to kick off. And I felt that field effect that the characters in this novel and the child that I once was in that particular location, I felt that chill of recognition because I saw all kinds of things. And my family, Tuscaloosa's about the size of the East Village. And that you may not have participated in one of those lynchings, but you knew the people who did. And I come from those people. And I got out of there as soon as I could. So I'm just saying the challenge, I think, for minorities, for the disabled, for the neurotypical, which may include more and more of us, as this neoliberal depression starts to be worked with, I think the challenge was for certainly James Baldwin and for any minority, if you're going, how do you talk to other members if you have to go through this media which is against you? And certainly that was true for gay people. Part of our impulse was we wanted to get in touch with other gay people, but we had to go through the straight media to do it. And the straight media pathologized us. And I think that, I'm just quoting something. We worked on personal pronouns, I, me, you, myself. And we all tracked that and drew some little pictures and shared. And I think there were differences that make a difference because we think in a very uniform way about these personal pronouns. And that uniformity, I think, could be challenged because I think we're much more fluid. But I didn't go into we or us or them. Maybe that'll be in another process. But between us and them, there is a we. And I think that's the incredible challenge that we're going through as we deal now, not just with the press, but with it, which is hostile and maybe pathologizing some of us who want to get together for whatever worthy cause. But there's also, this technology that we're operating with right now. And I believe what we're doing right now in this conversation is something different. I think we're using the technology in a way that it may not intended to have been used for. And I believe we can look at YouTube, we can look at all the research that's available to us. We can turn into consumers like they want us to become. I'm talking about they, them, and we. or we can use this technology differently. And I believe that that's what we're doing. I hope we do this better, and I hope we do more of it. And let's find the I that is we.
Maybe just before Heather leaves, I just want to say that we're going to meet again next week, a week from today. I think the sense we got last time is that people aren't quite ready to let the book go, and we need kind of a recap of the experience, what in French we call a bilan, which is not a summary exactly, but a kind of a closing up together of the, maybe a kind of a ritual thing would be, it has a ritual feel to it, I think, in a way that would be useful, so.
Nice, okay, next week.
Yeah.
Thank you. Bye, everyone.
Thanks, bye. See you tomorrow, Heather.
Yes, that's right.
I did want to come back on this issue of the depression, why I say that I feel that Erin is struggling to find something and that she doesn't quite get there. The Idle No More movement that she described has kind of I wouldn't say it doesn't exist anymore, but it's kind of fizzled out as a movement that engaged the Canadian public in an important way, just like the Occupy Wall Street movement sort of a few years before that also, and even the student protests, which were so predominant in Quebec, in the province for a couple of years ago, there's also been no follow-up from those encounters. And so one finds that even though there are these undercommons that develop, they're hard to sustain in this environment that we live in, this very neoliberal. The neoliberal culture has this incredible ability to absorb stuff and make it go away. And so I think there's a kind of a need to, maybe that's the next step beyond this text of Aaron's, is to look at how do you keep these spontaneous undercommons, how do you connect them up with each other, and how do you nurture something that will have a longer sustainability than the sort of local events that then subside and then another one emerges, because clearly they keep emerging, but they all tend to subside. So anyway, it's an outstanding question, is how do we nurture something that has a stronger, longer term effect into this? How do you take the minor gesture and turn it into something a little bit closer to a major gesture?
It sounds like Aaron's Sense Lab is an example of that. You know, it's a focal point, it seems, for ongoing experiments. I think we're doing something similar through Infinite Conversations and Cosmos as a cooperative. You know, the other example recent is Standing Rock. I remember it was nearby, the farm that we have a CSA with was bringing food up there, and it seemed like a last stand in a certain way against the pipeline builders and the oil and gas industry, and the winter came and it didn't last. And I know that people are still talking to each other, and there's a lot of, you know, even if there isn't a kind of flashpoint, even if there isn't something in the media, relationships emerge. And people continue communicating. I think that, like, that sort of mycelial layer is really important. But I think what's beyond that is something that begins to include the economics and begins to include organization, because, you know, it's important to have that living layer, but the living layer needs a kind of infrastructure to kind of hold on to, you know, to grow on. Even soil has a structure to it, and good soil, good healthy productive soil, has a structure to it that's formed by all the roots and the networks that are underneath it. So it's not just a kind of chaotic, random oppositional thing. I think building a lot of networks and structures that create alternatives to the media, and especially the commercialized and the centralized media, where the whole incentive is to get you to just keep your attention and keep your eyeballs, you know, so that you can be served advertisements. And that's what drives the media. So if we create alternative media, we create alternative economics, then that could provide an infrastructure for the kind of life forms and the modes of communication that, you know, that I think ultimately can lead to bigger scale change. That's my faith anyway. That's my growing faith. It's still I think still small. I think it needs to grow a lot more.
And certainly Aaron's efforts with she's talked about it, and she might have mentioned it a bit in the opening conversation about this, they're developing a a new university, a kind of, so a three ecologies university is what they're calling it. So that's certainly part of an effort to take it beyond the immediate. So Sense Lab is a fairly localized phenomenon. The idea is to extend it into a more institutional way. So
she's also working with alternative currencies.
Yeah.
The holochain, holo people, which that's an idea of computing, decentralized computing. So instead of relying on big corporations, you know, to manage all of our data, we'd be forming a network, would share our computing resources and manage our own data. I mean, I think that would be revolutionary in a lot of ways, but it's not just kind of a tech thing. It requires, I think, culture. It requires people being able to, if we can't rely on central authority, if authority has to be distributed amongst the community, then we really have to take responsibility for how we self-organize. And I think that's kind of the challenge. That's the leap, you know, that these movements might need to make. And I look forward to it. I think it's long overdue.
Maybe that's a good note to end the conversation today.
Affirmative.
And pick it up next week.
By the way, I found Ed Moten's book, Under Commons. There's a PDF that anyone who's interested in reading it.
I just haven't had time to look at it yet. But
I think it might be fun to look at a chapter from that to complement next meeting. Thank you.
Thanks. Thank you, Jeffrey. Thank you, everybody.
Thanks.
Thanks.